Now we have some remarks from friends and colleagues of Bill, John Driscoll, Dr. John Driscoll.
I thought the title of the first hymn today, "I Walk the Unfrequented Road," was really kind of shockingly appropriate. Bill was in many ways a person who loved other people. But at the same time, he was a bit of a loner. He was an introvert, as far as I knew him, and one of the most complex people that I've ever met. Complex, complicated, peripatetic, sensitive, emotional, bright, distinguished, focused. He was a man who believed in and loved standards. He loved quality. He loved quality in people, and he loved quality in the world that he experienced. Barbara used the word presence, and I also have the word presence in my comments today. And it was his presence and the reality of his presence that makes the presence of his absence all the more acute. It's hard to describe the many aspects of Bill's life and my life that intertwined. I think the fact that he came from a small town out west somehow gave us a sort of psychological union between us. I grew up in a small town loving the small town, but knowing that I didn't belong there at a very, very young age. And I think Bill felt the same way about his upbringing. The world of aesthetic concerns is hard to find in small communities sometimes. The drive for survival is so intense, and there are other issues that people are consumed by. But I think in Bill's life, the world of aesthetic concerns was very much tied to the world of being, the world of peace, the world of interactions between people. I met him at Penn State when I was a student there, and he was the founding director of the art museum. And I saw him for many years there, and subsequently as he mentored the people that came to the museum as graduate students. And he mentored the people who came to the museum as employees. And he mentored the people who came to the museum as collectors. And he mentored the people who came to the museum as artists. For all these things, I admired and loved him. You wouldn't think it, but he was a severe, tough taskmaster. I spent 7 years with him at Penn State as a graduate student, and I can tell you he was a demanding person to work for, but in the most gentle, humble, and unassuming way. He would never tell you that you'd done something wrong. He would never tell you about a better way to do something. He would ask you a question. Or in the midst of a conversation, he He would make what appeared to be an offhand comment, but you knew for sure it wasn't offhand. It was his ability to capture the essence of a moment in a question that would set you back and make you think and see what he was getting at, what he was trying to teach you. And he did it in such a relaxed, informal way that it really intensified the experience of learning. I've had a lot of professors in my life, but I never had anybody who was so effective in teaching as Bill was. He would make statements about himself, and once you got to know him, you knew that he was really talking about you. I think of the artists that he helped in his various positions here in Syracuse as the first associate director of the New York State Arts Council, as the, I think Bill is here, as the director of the Kentucky Arts Council, and at Penn State, artists for whom he arranged shows, arranged acquisitions, arranged publications. He was a constant advocate of everybody, every person that he believed in. And he found wonderful people and surrounded himself with wonderful people. It's interesting that he was able to do that, given this inherent shyness that he had. But he gave so much of himself to others that he would draw people in. He was a consummate professional with a very human and humane touch. In a challenging and violent world, he found peace and promoted peace in every action of his life and in the artwork that he loved. You can't talk about Bill without talking about food. And I had some pretty interesting food experiences with Bill. Bill introduced me to aspic. And you know, his aspics, he would put them out on the table, and they would just tremble with pride. Julia Child would have been in awe of his aspics. He could get an aspic out of the form onto the plate, and it looked great, and it tasted better. His pies have been mentioned. If Pillsbury Corporation had known about Bill's pies, there never would have been a Betty Crocker. It would have been Chef Bill. Bill and I traveled together a lot over the years. I remember one time we were down in North Carolina. We were traveling over the entire state collecting paintings for a retrospective of Hobson Pittman that Bill had organized, a show that went eventually to the Pennsylvania Academy after opening at Penn State. And so we were driving this van around North Carolina in our suits and couldn't find a place to eat. And of course I knew Bill well enough by that time to know that we had to find a good place to eat. But we were having a lot of trouble and nothing was presenting itself. So eventually I pointed out to him that there was a McDonald's coming up. I'd seen a sign on the road. So he said, okay. And we pulled into the McDonald's and went in, ordered our hamburgers and went over and sat down at a table. And I remember sitting there in this McDonald's in what appeared to me to be deepest, darkest North Carolina. And Bill looks at the food wrapped in paper and cardboard, opens it up, And somewhere, somehow, I don't know where from, he produces a knife and a fork. And he's eating his hamburger with a knife and a fork. And I'm looking around at all of the people in the restaurant, and they're all looking at Bill. And I'm thinking, we are not getting out of here untouched. So I introduced Bill to McDonald's. I think it was probably the first and last time he ever went into a McDonald's. And Bill, of course, knew how to play the game. And it was later in that week when we had made our way to the shore and we were staying in a nice hotel and we went downstairs to have dinner. And being a young kid at that time from the Midwest, I had never seen an oyster. And I think Bill must have remembered that little incident at McDonald's. So he ordered me a plate of oysters. And as this big tray of ice with these shells that looked like some old man's eyeballs was brought in front of me, I looked down and Bill says to me, "You have to be something of a cannibal to eat these, you know." I think I enjoyed those oysters about as much as he enjoyed the McDonald's hamburger. We had a lot of trips together. And Bill was a wonderful person to travel with and to visit museums, visit collectors, visit dealers. And we were continually going on the road. And I remember one time we were driving up here in New York State across the expressway, and we had the university van, which was a pure white truck, no designations on it whatsoever. And we pulled into this gas station on the expressway. And again, we're wearing suits. And we're driving this truck loaded with art. We've been in Boston. We're going to Buffalo to pick up art for an exhibition. This fellow comes out to pump gas, and he's standing there looking at us, and he's chewing on a toothpick, and he's got the gas pump there, and he's looking at us, and we're looking at him, and he's looking at us. And finally he says, "Antique dealers." And we, of course, weren't smart enough to deny it. So he said, "What you got in the truck? Valuable antiques?" And we look at him, he says, "Well, you're dressed in suits, you got an unmarked van here, what do you got in the truck?" Well, the rest of the way to Buffalo, Bill and I were sweating bullets because we figured that guy went in, made a phone call, and we were gonna be stopped by some raiders along the way. On another trip, we were making our way from State College out to Lincoln, Nebraska, returning paintings to people, to museums that we had borrowed for an exhibition. And it was going to be a week and a half long trip, and so we brought some music with us, some these little compact discs that were popular then. And I had brought along with me Carl Orff's Carmina Burana, which I really enjoyed listening to. And I remember two or three days into the trip, I put this in the player, and Bill was driving. And it started in, and Bill was driving. And the next thing I know, his hand goes over and it turns up the volume a little bit. And when he turns up the volume, his foot goes down on the accelerator. So then he's driving a little more, and he reaches over a couple minutes later, he turns the volume up, and a foot goes down. And he did that again, and it was like this van full of art was bouncing down the highway. And I learned from that that it wasn't such a good idea to have Carmina Burana on playing in the car when Bill was driving. And I tried to talk him into letting me drive, but he had this thing where you could only switch drivers at every rest stop. So even though we were switching quite often, every time he got behind the wheel, and for some reason he decided that that was the music for the trip and he was playing it every time he was driving. We had another wonderful trip where we were up here in New York again. And again, with the university van filled up with paintings from Albright Knox and Munson Williams Proctor and some other museums up here. And we're heading back to Pennsylvania. And Bill says, you know, let's go by the wine country. Let's get a couple bottles of wine. So we went to Dr. Christian Franck's winery. And we meet in the parking lot Dr. Franck, and he sees us. We get out of, again, the white van with our suits, and he latches onto us. And Bill says, well, he wants to buy a couple of bottles of wine. He says, no, you can't buy a couple of bottles until you've had my talk. So we had to go in and we had to listen to Dr. Franck talk about his wine for 15 or 20 minutes. Well, Bill came out of that and he said, you know, this is really good wine because there are no chemicals in it and it's organic and it's going to be really good wine. So Bill buys four cases of wine. And we take it and we put it in the back of the truck, lock up the trunk, and we're driving away. And I'm sitting there, Bill's driving again, and I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, is it legal to bring wine from New York State into Pennsylvania? And I don't know why that occurred to me, but for some reason it did. And so at some point, as we're approaching the New York-Pennsylvania border, I just said to Bill, is it okay to bring this wine into Pennsylvania? Well, in those days it wasn't. I don't know what the laws are now, and presumably the statute of limitations has expired on this. But I asked Bill that, and all of a sudden he looked at me with this terror in his face, and he pulled the truck over, and he looked at me again, and he got out, and he looked up and down the road, and he looked up in the air. He got back in, and he says, how far is it to the border? I said, well, it's about 5 miles. And he gunned it, and we were off. And neither one of us said a word for 30 minutes, and I'm not exaggerating, but we got 20 miles past the border, and we were okay. But I had visions that whole time of us being arrested, the truck being impounded, the contents being taken over by the state of New York. What were we going to do? And then there was a time when we were going to the Renwick in Washington, walking down the street. We hear this familiar voice saying, Bill, Bill. And Bill looks up and looks across the street. And there's Nelson Rockefeller, Vice President of the United States, with his entourage walking in the opposite direction. But he'd looked up and he'd seen Bill. So he's calling Bill and hailing Bill to come over. So Bill walked across the street and he's talking to Rockefeller, whom he had known from his days on the New York State Arts Council. And I'm standing there thinking, this is pretty cool. Bill is a pretty cool guy. He is a really cool guy. And he was. You know, I think the thing in all of this that made me love Bill the most were a few experiences that I had with him relative to his family. When I first met Bill, he had just come to Penn State, and Margot had stayed in Kentucky to finish school. And Margot, you have no idea how he fretted over that. And in fact, for all these years, when Bill and I were close together, and when we were distant, when we got together and talked, Margot was always part of the conversation. And his passion, his compassion, his love for his family was really manifest in how he felt about Margot, and how he felt about Tavery when Tavery arrived. And I thought to myself, when Tavery was born, this is the best thing that ever could have happened. And indeed it was. And I think the intensity of how he felt about his family did in fact come from his upbringing, where I think he wanted more out of his personal relationships with his family than maybe he had felt he had as a young person in this remote place out in the prairie of Washington. I am almost exactly the same age that his son Freddie was. We were born in the same year, just months apart. And because Bill and I were traveling together so often, he would occasionally speak to me about Freddie. And I remember one night, we were again staying in a hotel. We'd gone down to dinner, and Bill was very, very quiet through dinner. And he looked up very near when the dinner was over, and he looked at me and he said, "I'm so glad that we've had this day together." He said, "This is the day that Freddie died." On another occasion, he told me it was Freddie's birthday. And I think for both of us, it was both a blessing and a curse that I was so close in age to the son that he lost. I don't think that kind of experience of losing a child is anything that anybody ever gets over, and certainly Bill never did. Freddie and Margot and then Tavery were always in his minds. And I felt connected to Bill through this in a very personal, poignant sort of way. And we talked about it occasionally, but we didn't talk about it occasionally also, because I think the feelings for him were so raw, even years later. And then, of course, there was the passing of Carolyn. And I've had this, I'm going to say a few things now, that I've only had conversation about this with one person, and that was Bill. I had made plans to go to London for a trip, and Bill and Carolyn were going to New York, and so I rode into New York with them to catch the plane. And we had a wonderful time driving into the city. And they were staying at a hotel. We went to the hotel, and then I got a taxi from there to go out to the airport. I was going to be gone for 2 weeks. And it turned out, I was going to be gone 2 weeks on a ceramics buying expedition, which of course was inspired by Bill himself. And I got over there, and I was there for about a week. And one morning, about 2 a.m, in this hotel room, I had this absolutely terrifying experience, waking up, feeling like somebody was pushing me. And I didn't know what it was, but it scared me. It really, really scared me. And I got up and I packed my bags and I went down. I checked out of the hotel and I went to the airport. I found a flight coming back. I called my wife, told her that I was coming home, And I couldn't explain anything about it other than I knew I had to get home. It was a rough trip. The weather was bad. I got to New York. There was a snowstorm. I found a bus that was coming out. They didn't know if the buses were going to run because the weather was so bad. But I got to State College. My wife came and picked me up. It was about 2 a.m. And I went in, I went to bed. The next morning, late-ish in the morning, there was a knock at our door. And it was Bill Davis, who was the assistant director of the Art Museum. He came in, and he told us that Carolyn had died in the morning. It was some sort of divine intervention that got me to come back. And we went over to Bill and Carolyn's house, and Bill came down from upstairs. He was very, very shocked to see me because he knew I was in London and wasn't scheduled to come back for another week. Later, 2 months later, he and I were together and he asked me how I came to be there. So I told him this story. And he looked at me and he just smiled and nodded. Later, I went to Selkirk. And for those of you who have been to Selkirk, you know the presence of Bill in that place. You know the presence of the entire family in that place. And I wrote him a little something later called The Nimbus of Selkirk, because I knew the presence of the family there and the presence of Bill there. Bill was a man of many and great, significant achievements in life. And I think the greatest was that of how he felt about his family and how he felt about people that he really cared about and how he filled our hearts and our minds. And I embrace his memory and his life with gratitude and with gladness. Thank you.